Time for the weekly update. Malcolm Honlein's with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, with us Friday, 7:40 a.m. Eastern Time for the weekly update. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, especially as we look forward with hope to Purim and to another redemption of the Jewish people.
Amen to that. How I hope your sentiments come true. It's strange, by the way. I spoke to a bunch of people in Israel today, and of course they're much closer to the situation. No one's quite sure how to celebrate this holiday of Purim. I've heard everything from we're the Jewish people, and when it's a time for Simcha, we've got to, you know, go all out. And of course, many other people have said they're trying to calm things down a bit and remember the situation that we are all in, especially our brothers and sisters in Israel. Any thoughts on this, or everyone should make their own individual account for their own family and group?
Well, we all make our own accounts, but I think the lesson of Purim is Lech Knosis Kol Yehudim, that everybody has to see it in the context of all of Klal Yisrael, and especially of our brothers and sisters in Israel now, who face, you know, still challenges of a war that's going on that becomes too routine for people not. That tens of thousands of young people and older people are standing in defense of the Jewish people, and that the antidote that Queen Esther taught us, Lech Knosis Kol Yehudim, that the answer, those who think we are Mufuzar Mufarad, is only unity. So while we celebrate in our own families, and we should be appreciative of our individual brachot, we have to look at this in a much broader context. I think the lesson is very clear with all of the anti-Semitism, that we are Am Echad B'Lev Echad, that what happens to one part of us happens to all of us.
And one other thing, and I know there's a lot of news to discuss, but you just hit on such an important point. My niece reminded me of this this morning. Tomorrow we're going to read Parsha Zachar. I remind everybody, even with the rough weather in the New York, New Jersey area, still everyone's got to go to shul and hear Parsha Zachar. And one of the phrases, and I'm sure you've thought of this and have heard this over the years, one of the phrases in Parsha Zachar is Ata Ayef V'Yageya, God saying that you are tired and essentially fatigued by the entire thing, as Amalek, of course, is trying to surround you, attack you, etc. And if there's one thing that we're concerned about, and you've mentioned this, is of course it's the war fatigue that people, especially those outside of Israel and some in Israel, you know, it's human nature. They go ahead and all of us go ahead and and start to lose the enthusiasm, so to speak, for the war effort. Isn't it amazing that in the paragraph that discusses how we have to remember and destroy Amalek, that factor is mentioned, that we must ignore and persevere over the war fatigue?
Absolutely, but it also shows what cowards they were, that they attacked the weak, the tired, the laggards behind, and the terrorists do the same thing. The terrorists don't confront an army. The terrorists go after civilians. They try to attack when people are not prepared. They hide in rat holes under the ground, out, you know, to kill and to run back in. They don't stand and fight. And I think you see what's happening at Shifa Hospital, where 650 terrorists have been caught. They use a hospital and the patients as a cover because they know the international community will come down on Israel for it. I think a lot of faces, and I saw it in Washington, about, you know, being critical of the attack on Shifa until they found that this was a major operational base, and all the weapons they found, the terrorists who are hiding there and ranking ones. So it's a dual lesson. It's that we cannot become tired, and we cannot, but we cannot let them go after the most vulnerable in our communities, whether it's against fighting the anti-Semitism on our campuses and where the enemy hides behind masks and does all the terrible things to students and try to pick them off when they are alone. But when we stand united, we can overcome them all.
And for those who wonder whether they are actually, whether the terrorists and those who you just spoke about are actually Amalek, I think you've made the point, and I think it's really important for people to remember that. Sometimes when you're in it, it's hard to see the bigger picture. By the way, you mentioned the hospital. Someone used the phrase this week of revolving door, that as Israel goes in, they take out the terrorists, they discover what's there in terms of the operation, then Israel leaves a facility like that hospital. It doesn't have to be necessarily that one, but like that hospital. And sure enough, you know, within days or weeks, everything, the arsenal is rebuilt. The terror presence is back again. Is that essentially what's going on in those types of buildings?
I likened it to building a sandcastle, and then the water comes in and erases it, and it goes out. You build it again, the water will come back in. They fill in the voids. This is, they will keep moving around because they can do it underground. They can do it within the civilian populations. But Israel has been, obviously its intelligence has been very good. Its operational activities have been great, although we've lost too many. When you think about the fact that they have to go in virtually exposed because the terrorists hide everywhere, and they literally go apartment to apartment in order to find the launchers, the rocket launchers, the weapons. And you see in individual homes, in a nursery room, the weapons that are hidden underneath mattresses and everywhere that they have to uncover, because otherwise they will be used again. But at some point, when you eliminate some of the leading officers, as they did at Jaffa and over recent weeks, including Mari and number three in Hamas, and they will get Sinwar eventually. We believe many of them are, in fact, in Rafah, and the international community's pressure about not going in and threatening Israel in all sorts of ways. I mean, would they have threatened the United States for having to go into Dresden or having to go to other places or dropping bomb fighting Japan? And think about how many lives would be saved if Israel is able to eliminate all these terrorists now and going into Rafah will be a requirement. The question is how they go in. And you see that so far they've been doing targeted assassinations, which are very effective. They caught them off guard because they didn't see the massive movement of troops. But they watch everything, and they can see any time Israel is making a big move, and they can go underneath back into the tunnel system and move north and south. So you're right, it is an additional challenge. But at some point, it breaks, and that's why hundreds of terrorists have surrendered.
I wanted to actually start on this side of the world, but and we'll get to this side of the world in a second, but you're raising such an important point about what's actually happening and what type of activities the terrorists are undertaking and undergoing in these areas that you just described. And I'm wondering if you saw, just to give everybody a perspective, especially those on this side of the world who've been in the New York City subway system, did you see the comparison in terms of square miles between the New York City the New York City subway system, which of course is a complicated network of tunnels, and the comparison in the number of square miles of the tunnels that have been built by the enemy in Gaza? Did you see those stats?
I've seen in the past, I saw the comparison to the London Underground, and it's bigger in Gaza than the London.
And Gaza and New York are basically the same. And again,
about the same, right, equivalent.
And again, right. For those who've been in the subway and have ridden the system, imagine that. I mean, it really helps put things in perspective for those of us on this side of the world.
And you think how many years and how many billions they spend on the Second Avenue subway and can't get it done.
Right.
And these guys are building, and Israel is constantly uncovering new ones, a north-south one that runs kilometers, and also is one of the reasons why they could escape, because Israel doesn't know every routine, because every route until you actually trace each of the openings and looks to where they go, because some of them can be shorter, some of them can be longer. But the network itself encompasses a good part. By the way, in the north, underneath southern Lebanon, there's even a bigger network because they've been working on it much longer. And people think that this is, very easy to build. No, these are very complicated, sophisticated networks. I saw the tunnel that they dug under the border to Lebanon, and it doesn't go across. It goes down first, very far down, maybe 2-3 stories down, and then goes across. So even if you can detect from above and from by airplanes and penetrating X-ray the ground, you don't see it unless you hit the exact location. And inside, there's sophisticated equipment, air conditioning, electrical systems, communication systems. Also inside, in the hewn into the rock of the mountain, these tunnels. And so the underground in Lebanon, which covers most of southern Lebanon, rivals that what we've seen in Hamas, and they share the technology on how to do it.
Is tunnel building a sophisticated skill? Like, where do they find these people who are able to do it?
Well, first of all, they train them. Iran sent in technicians to teach, like, the weapons, the use of sophisticated weapons, the guidance systems. But they get technical assistance, maybe China, maybe North Korea, who are allies of theirs. But you know what? They're talented people, even amongst them. And it takes a lot of work. And believe me, they don't pay minimum wage. And you enlist the people to the Hamas, drafts the people, and puts them to work in digging these tunnels. And there are multiple ones that... you know, that baffles sometimes Western minds. They can't believe it until you actually see it.
Unbelievable. All right, back to this side of the world. This is not a rant and rave. This is just trying to understand the timeline and what you know about the reaction to the situation. We know that 8 days ago, Senator Schumer did what he did on the floor of the United States Senate, and we know how those of us who follow, you know, statements by Jewish organizations, we know how many reacted around this country to what he did, and we certainly have seen between the Sunday television programs and news programs and other things. We've seen the reaction from Israel as well. What's the timeline? Because I'm trying to understand. He spoke or was on a Zoom with the Conference of Presidents this week post that Senate floor presentation? Was that a reference to something that happened before the Senate floor presentation? Just take me through the timeline here.
So he gave the speech. It was not at the direction of the White House. It was his initiative. He informed them about it just before he gave the speech. Obviously, he worked on it some time. You don't have a speech of that kind, although it rehashed things that he has said in the past, including the Shomer Yisrael. And then on the following day, he contacted the Conference of Presidents office.
That means Friday, 1 week ago today.
So, right, Friday. And asked them not to issue a statement until he has a chance to talk to them. Then he called and he said that he would do a conference call with the conference on Monday. And they had the conference call. It did not achieve, I think, the purposes he intended. They did issue a statement, a critical statement afterwards. And some members dissented from it, but a minority. And you've seen that there were statements issued already Friday by some organizations, and some on Sunday and some on Monday.
Right.
And thereafter.
All right. So whatever he tried to do in terms of, I don't know if we're calling it walking back or clarifying, that I think I could safely say you thought did not work, right?
I don't think that he undid the damage that was done. I don't know that you can undo the damage. It's why, you know, Lashon Hara can't be just taken right back, and especially not against, you know, that you can do tshuva for any, almost everything. You can't do tshuva when you talk Lashon Hara against Israel, because the damage that's done is instant. The messages that the extremists were demonstrating picked up from it, the encouragement that was probably, I will assume it's not his intent, but it was certainly the effect.
Right.
Of the speech.
Well, then you know what this audience wants to know based on your evaluation. Does he understand the damage that was done? Is this something that's lost on him? Or now post that speech on the Senate floor, he understands that this may have been somewhat, I guess he would say, I can't imagine he would say a complete damaging episode, but somewhat of a damaging episode to Israel.
I don't know. I would assume that, you know, he's heard both reactions. The problem is that all the people who are angry, including listening to the show, don't contact his office, don't let him know, whereas those who want to support it and welcome it made their voices known very loudly and repeatedly to his office and to him, and certainly on the floor of the Senate. You know, he gets limited criticism, although I will tell you, I was in Washington this week. And I hope we can talk about it, because we dealt with another issue with alumni, the students telling stories to members of Congress of the anti-Semitism they personally faced on campus. And I tell you, it was so shocking for some of them. They sat there open mouthed and kept saying, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, that things that we assumed they knew after the three presidents' testimony,
Right.
They didn't. So, but I can tell you that members privately said to me, the good guys, that this was shocking to them, that they didn't support it. And, you know, there are many members of Congress who have signs outside their offices, which, you know, there aren't many signs outside people's offices. There are a couple that had the pictures, Josh Gonheimer, Daniel Webster, others, which had the pictures of the Futterman of the hostages.
Right.
But many had signs that say, "We stand with Israel," blue and white signs.
Wow.
That were outside their, I mean, I had not known this, and I was walking down the halls, and I'm seeing this, and I start taking pictures because I thought it was only one guy. And then I see that there were many of them in different offices around the House and some in the Senate where people proudly proclaimed their position. So I can tell you that some of his colleagues were very critical and concerned about the impact. They're concerned in general. They understand that Israel, you know, support for Israel could be jeopardized. You saw that 18 members, you know, called for ceasefire and would call for even more. And some are even talking about conditioning aid, something that was pretty sacrosanct in the past. Canada is talking about withholding arms and not selling arms to Israel. Some Europeans are talking about conditioning or withholding arms, which would be a terrible thing. That's why Israel has become arms self-sufficient like they are in other areas.
Oh, wow. I'm glad you said that. I don't know if, has that always been your position on that, by the way?
Absolutely, but it wasn't always possible. Right. You know, it's a huge investment to build. Look, we had in the United States, we have two plants making ammunition, and they operate now, I think, 24-7. There's a shortage, a global shortage of weapons, and when they're providing to Taiwan and to Ukraine and to Israel, let alone for our own forces, it becomes a global shortage and certainly a shortage here.
Right.
So Israel can't be dependent on others. They have to build their own capacity, and you will see that emerge. In the coming years, it'll take a lot of infrastructure to do that, but I hope that it will not take that long, so they're less dependent.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsor digital radio around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course on the beloved NSN app. I was asked to announce in the middle of this segment, there are people in our audience still a bit technologically challenged, and their children and grandchildren would like to know what phone number can be used if a person simply wants to use a phone number to call in and hear this segment or any segment on JM and the AM and the Nahum Siegel Network. Let me do this quickly. The listen line, as we call it, is area code 518-931-1184. Again, the listen line, if you want to just call the phone number and listen to this network live at any time, 518-931-1184. Malcolm Honlein with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. You mentioned the collegiate event. How many, do you know how many colleges were represented? Was it two or three stories? Was it 10 stories? How many different tales of campus situations were told to members of Congress at that formal gathering this week?
So it was representative of hundreds, if not thousands, of events. There were students from 20 universities convened by Olami who flew them in from Stanford to Princeton, from Michigan to Arizona State, William and Mary College, every kind of college you can imagine, state colleges, other University of Michigan, and certainly NYU and Drexel, Penn. And it's amazing. And I have to tell you, as much as I work on this all the time and have been involved with it, when you hear it firsthand, when a student tells about a dorm door being burnt in the middle of the night of their room, of the dorm of their room, because by anti-Semites and anti-Israel people, when kids walking home from a Shabbat meal at Chabad is assaulted, and the most staggering thing of all was that in almost every instance, where I would say every instance, the university did not respond at all, or gave pro forma responses, or advised the kids to get mental counseling, or, I mean, just the most outrageous things that the police on campus or off campus did not respond to the often repeated incidents that were happening on these campuses across the country. And they were pressing for legislation that would require the OCR under Title VI, which everybody should know about, and get the Department of Education, with whom they met also. And I would not say had any satisfaction from that meeting, listening to the people's sympathetic responses, but ineptitude and inability on their part to respond. And they just kept pressing that we should get Congress to give them more money. Well, they I saw a letter that they sent out listing 7-8 groups that are targets of discrimination, including Palestinians, but no mention of Jews. And Jews represent the vast majority of the acts of the bias, both in our cities and on our campuses. So the shock was a dual one. One that these members of Congress, and I would say without exception, left, right, Republican, Democrat, were not aware of the degree to which, and I would say most of our audience not aware of the degree to which these things are taking place in virtually every campus across the country. And some you don't have, you know, you may have individual Jewish students or small groups, and they don't even know how to go about processing their complaints beyond filing a letter. Some of them kept very distinct records, copies of all the emails, sometimes 20, 30 communications that went unanswered. Think whether this would be tolerated towards other ethnic or racial groupings in the United States, and that the students are finally standing up and speaking up and telling the stories of what they encountered, what others encountered, how in classrooms they do it. And as I told you, that we're hearing more and more from faculty about anti-Semitism that they're confronting and their own careers being put in jeopardy.
Parents have to pay a lot more attention to this before they and their children, or as they help their children, make a decision about where to go for college. On social media this week, someone made a statement that you have to be crazy if you're Jewish to go to Stanford. I never realized the level of anti-Semitism on that campus. They say it's a yotze min haklal. It's so much more than others, which I don't know if that's true or not, but just to hear it is amazing. And, you know, these are prominent college campuses throughout the United States. Whoever thought that members of the Jewish community would feel uncomfortable in that type of environment?
Well, Harvard may, in fact, be the worst. So the places that get extolled and that people want to go to, in various rankings, Harvard on the speech level and other things was amongst the worst. Wow. Maybe now, because the donors stopped giving it because there was a shakeup of the presidents, maybe it will help. We have yet to see real change, but what we have seen is that there are quotas on Jewish admissions now at Harvard, at Yale, at Penn, at other places, reminiscent of what happened in the 40s, and that the students are being told, you know, to go to other places when they confront some of these incidents and said, well, if you're not, you don't feel safe here, not saying, you know, we have to change the culture on the campus because you're creating a society that will be driven by hatred. And it's not, and as we know, the Jews may be the first victims, we're never the last. We see anti-Asian discrimination. We see discrimination against other groups as well. You know, Islamophobia is always thrown in, but if you look at the numbers, it pales in comparison to the anti-Jewish acts that take place. And I'm talking about physical assaults. We're talking about harassment. We're talking about taking down the signs that they put up of the children hostages. And the guy had a knife and was standing down when he was confronted. He turned the knife and started threatening the students and that confronted him. And when pressed to the university, they don't even describe it. They don't want to file as anti-Semitic things because then, you know, the Title VI and the Department of Education looks at it, and there is more being done in terms of reporting, but hardly enough. And we want to see uniform forms given out so that every incident has to be investigated, it has to be reported, so that there will be clear statistics and transparency. There isn't. There isn't in regard to the funding they're getting from foreign sources like Qatar, billions and billions of dollars over the last few years that have been poured onto our campuses, with them having influence over naming of faculty, with the curricula impacting the curricula, and the direct correlation that we found between foreign funding and increased anti-Semitism on the campuses. And the foreign funding is much more widespread. And now, of course, the added dimension that we're finding in the public schools across the country, there are organizations being formed of parents of public school children across the country, some with thousands of members, because the situation in public high schools and even sometimes in elementary schools is intolerable.
Wow. Unbelievable. Parents, rabbinic leaders in this country, community leaders in this country, this is a topic that we need to pay a lot more attention to. It's expected that later today, the United Nations Security Council will vote on a United States-sponsored resolution declaring that an immediate sustained ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza is imperative. Obviously, the U.S. is going to vote in favor of this. Not one of those resolutions are going to abstain from, right? I assume this will pass unanimously?
Resolution, and Israel has said that they can live with it. It's tied to the end is also tied to the release of the hostages, and it's a humanitarian ceasefire is the goal. It's not a permanent ceasefire. I found that both in my meetings with administration and with members of Congress, I mean, they get it that Israel just can't walk away and leave Hamas victorious. If you listen to what the Arab leaders are saying, I mean, they can't live with it. Because it's a threat to them, certainly to Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf countries, Morocco, all of them, all of our allies will pay.
You know who else can't live with it, by the way, unless these rumors are not true? The Gazans who snuck out or figured out a way to pay their way out of Gaza. Because it seems that now the majority of them, when they speak to the press, all they do is condemn Hamas and hope that Israel could take out Hamas completely.
Right, and courageous voices inside Gaza that have talked to the press, and you see them condemning what Hamas has brought upon them. And, you know, but still, the latest statistics show that 70-some percent think October 7th was right. The vast majority still support Hamas. Now, whether they do it out of fear or not, we don't know. But right. But the numbers really are pretty indicative. You know, so a few voices, sound voices coming out and declaring themselves otherwise.
Right.
Look at these latest polls. It's pretty disturbing.
Yeah, and I guess it makes sense that those who are desperate to flee are obviously not going to have favorable comments to make about Hamas, generally speaking. I get that. The Blinken trip to the Middle East, do you think we're going to, because, do you think this trip will result in a closer position to a hostage deal? And subsequent to that, could you just address, If they're getting the humanitarian aid, or at least this perception now that they're able to live with, you know, that Hamas is able to live with, that they're not, you know, that now the people in Gaza are getting the aid they need, because that's certainly the perception, whether it's reality or not. Why on earth would Hamas be encouraged to make a deal? What is it that the world, that the U.S., that Israel, that anybody can hold over them if they're essentially being given what they need or what they want to have, you know, to be looked upon favorably in the public's eye?
So I'll tell you first, it's a good question, but I'll tell you first the reverse, that I know what will not dissuade them from continuing and fighting, and that is every time anybody of these leaders says something against Israel or demands a ceasefire, that they feel that they will be let off the hook, that Sinwar thinks he can survive if they continue fighting, rather than giving in and surrendering. Why should they if they think that the international community is going to stop arms to Israel, is going to stop supporting Israel, and if they hold out, they will emerge with the ability to, you know, show dignity and victory in their definition. So that's certainly the wrong approach. Second, about overall,
Blinken and the deal, right?
The what?
Blinken and the deal.
Yeah. So what I think Blinken is looking for is some sort of a temporary resolution where the infirm and the most vulnerable of the hostages gets released, and we have an interim 4 to 6 weeks. Israel has agreed to doing something, but on condition that it's not an end to the conflict, that Israel has the right to go in and will continue to police during the time that the agreement is going on. So far, Blinken has made, I don't know what, 8, 9, 10 trips to the Middle East. They haven't yielded real results as of this date. I think it's important to show that movement is still going on, because if everything stops, then you have the Arab countries coming under even greater pressure, and the forces, the demands on Israel will be even greater. So you got to just show, and Israel, I think, is going to reflect some flexibility so that, you know, they're not taking the heat for what Hamas is doing. You know, if you look at where the Europeans and others are, the United States is still standing in a better place than many of those other so-called allies, and especially in Canada. I hope all those listening in Canada are making their voices heard to the Trudeau government. It's outrageous that they say they're not going to sell weapons, and whether it really is so vital, the weapons that they sell, it becomes a cover. Then Europeans and others say, well, Canada's doing it, so can we. Canada's America's closest ally, our northern border. And, you know, you can't convince people that they didn't do it with permission from the United States.
Yeah, understood. What does it mean when we see a report that says the Red Cross was directly involved in the PA's pay-for-slay policy?
So that has yet to be fully digested and proven. But we know that all these human rights groups that claim to be human rights groups are being seconded by the Hamas system, that they can't operate independently, that if they want to operate at all in Gaza and sometimes in Yehudim Shomron also, that they have to compromise with the terrorist groups because they don't accept anything less than full compliance. I mean, Hamas and others from the Red Cross. So the Red Cross can be a vehicle by which money is transferred. We have seen how ambulances are taken over to transport terrorists from north to south and east to west or within areas. And they've been caught doing it repeatedly. So the accusations, and we've seen it in regard to UNRWA, where UNRWA staff was directly involved, and there are some accusations about Red Cross staff facilitating, but UNRWA guys were actually involved on October 7th, and the world now starts already refunding UNRWA. They haven't reformed. They haven't fired all the people who were involved in all of this, who corrupted the agency, and which shouldn't exist in any event. There's no place else where a fourth generation is being treated as refugees and receiving billions of dollars, and that gets wasted. And the the mollycoddling of the Palestinians, who receive more per capita than anybody. I don't hear the world mobilizing for all of the refugees who are truly facing famine in places like Sudan or Congo or others. And we should know that the images you get of the food, you see the food deliveries and stuff. There is plenty of food there for Ramadan. They showed a picture of people sitting down, in, like an aerial shot, sitting down with the soup bowls that were green. And they were saying, oh, you see, they're forced to eat grass. It's not. It is a soup that is customary for this during Ramadan. But the continued lies and distortions, and the reason that they don't get the food in some areas is because Hamas takes it. They found huge storage places where Hamas took this stuff, and then they sell it on the markets. They sell it to vendors. They don't even cover the boxes. They are UNRWA boxes. You see the people in the markets selling this stuff to the people, which creates a great deal of resentment. And some have been courageous enough to go to the press and point it out and declare that you guys are giving aid here, but Hamas steals it, and we have to now pay for the aid we're supposed to be receiving.
Malcolm, we're people of faith. We have to continue to believe that the modern-day Hamans will enjoy the same fate that the Haman of ancient times experienced.
I believe it. I think we will emerge from this stronger, united as a people. Ask any real estate agent in Israel about the number of requests they're getting from Americans and Europeans for apartments and houses. There are not even enough. There's not enough stock for all of the demands. And this is not just Yerushalayim, it's not just Ra'anana, I'm talking about in various places across the country that I hear from people all the time. So I think a lot of people are getting the true message of this, and unfortunately we paid a very heavy price. The support that we're giving has to increase, and people with their Matanos Levionim have to remember those in Israel as well as the people here. There are families who have suffered the loss of their breadwinners and the damage to their homes, and to all the displaced people, all those serving in the army for months who didn't have income sufficient for their families. We have to remember all of them. But I believe in the end, we will come out a stronger people and a stronger Israel.
Amen. Chag Purim Sameach. We'll speak, please God, next week. Malcolm Honlein, weekly update, Conference of Presidents, major American Jewish organizations. By the way, Malcolm just mentioned Matanot Levionim for Israel. Remember Lior Teji's fund, everybody. She's been on the air a million times with us over the last 20 years. She's giving out a lot of money on Sunday to families in need. remember all of these families in some way, shape, or form affected by terror, right? It's families of victims of terror. If you'd like to support the cause and assist her in giving Matanot Levyonim, Tzedakah on Purim, to families in need, go to the following website and make a donation, terror-victims.org.il, terror-victims.org.il. And we thank you. It's an amazing thing that she does on a regular basis, as many of you know, because many of you have seen her operation.